sorry. In 1957, a film came out called The Rising of the Moon. You may have heard of it. And astronomers in Northern Ireland, this caused a lot of controversy. So often papers started bringing troubles back, causing dissension and all the rest of it. And coming from a house where there was no political talk, I didn't understand what this was all about. And I was at boarding school, way out in the Antrim Coast, and they started to bring a film every Friday night for the boarders, which was great. We got things like Nanook of the North, the Men of Arran. When they got rid of the Nanooks and the Men of Arran, we started to get things like the Dambusters, the One That Got Away, and One Week, the Bachelor of Hearts. And in it, at one point, a fellow tears a towel of a girl to cover his own nakedness, because there's a hand over the lens of that particular point in time. The thing I found about the film, the Rising Moon, he brought it to his college one Friday night, and it turned out it's in three different parts. The first part apparently was with a boy who suddenly came into money, bought the motorbike of his dreams, put his girl in the pavilion, and drove around Ireland looking at old abbeys and castles and having a picnic and sand inside, which is more like a travelogue than anything else. The second part of it was a comedy about an old English couple waiting for a train at an Irish station. The train hasn't arrived because the local hurley team were away playing a big match. And they've won the cup, and there's no way the train can depart until they get the boys out of the pub. And eventually they appear with the cup, with their injured carried head high on hurdles. I think they could be dead, but that's the way it went. It's the third part of the film that caused the trouble, as far as the politicians were concerned. And it was to do, said about 1920, some guy was in a prison, not specified where, he's going to be hung the next day for terrorist activities. And the IRA came up with this plan to get him out. They sent in two girls dressed as nuns. And the fellas took one of the robes, put it on, got out of the prison. The guard that was left was sitting there when the guards appeared, and she's holding up an American passport saying, "You can jail me, but you can't hang me." Which was a very polite way of reminding everybody then that De Valera should have been executed in 1916, only he had an American passport. So it sort of did him politically very good. But what caught me in that story, that film, was not what was happening about the escape. The real story was outside, an old police sergeant wandering about on patrol and starting to get a feeling that something was happening. And of course he worked out what was going to happen, and then he this conflict of interest. Did he go by his oath of allegiance to king and country to uphold the law and stop the escape? Or did he, as an Irishman, know that killing people like that only caused more trouble and let them get away? And when I came many years later to write about an old Irish policeman in Ballymena, I remembered this conflict. And could I say that this old Irish policeman, John Barlow, that I wrote write about in my novels, is based on a real character who said he came from Cork, who said he came from Tipperary, who told the mother of Liam Neeson, the actor, they came from Mayo, and I know for a fact he came from Galway, because I went up to the police museum and asked. So, what happened? I want to read this story about Barlow, part of the book, and it's this conflict. Is that the conflict is the town of Ballymena, as always, was run by the big boys for themselves. They used the law to suit themselves. So what about this conflict? How to control them, and how to let the ordinary guy get justice, which wasn't necessarily the law. He also had a problem with two old wartime comrades. There was Geordie Dunlop, a total ne'er-do-well, who was always in trouble, and Barlow owes Geordie big time from the war, so he's always trying to keep that trouble down a bit. Another is a major effort to dare, George Cross, Military Cross, who started life as the owner of Balmina Castle and is now living in a wooden hut under Curl's Bridge and is a total alcoholic. It's Christmas time. Every Christmas, Edward checks into the police station to get his food and drink and comfort over Christmas. This Christmas he can't get in because there's a new district inspector who's not allowed to happen. And Edward being Edward, and drunks being thick and thrown, and Edward having generations of blood that had never been known of refusal, is taking this very badly. In this station, it starts Barlow's in the front office with the Sergeant Pearson, who wants his job, and the district inspector wants to give Pearson the job, so there's always this conflict between the two. In the cells, there's a man being arrested for murder, and there's two of Geordie Dunlop's grandsons who got drunk the night before and started a row. I call this a bad day at the office. The front door opened. Edward Adair progressed in. His eyes were red-rimmed. The great coat he wore, thinned by use, was a fragment of his former glory. In contrast, Serge's oiled and brushed to shine, his regimental tie done up in a neat winter knot. Edward announced, "I'm here to confirm my accommodation for the festive season." Sergeant Pearson twitched as if attacked by fleas, but didn't dare scratch himself. "Go away," said Barlow. Edward ignored him and beamed at Pearson. "Young man, having failed to secure my accommodation on a voluntary basis, and I wish to place myself in police custody." Barlow said, "Not my Edward, not my." Edward, with his hand on his heart, went on to swearing a great oath. "I, Edward, George, Charles, Adele, confess that I did willfully and deliberately with malice aforethought, caused and compelled by means of threats or other illegal means, attempt to give monies, or with blackmail or extortion, and that in addition." Pearson's mouth opened wider and wider, filled up with metallic fillings. Barlow grabbed Edward by the collar, dragged him to fire out of earshot. Before he could speak, the front door opened again, this time impelled by a kick. An aging man, Geordie Dunlop, pulled in. Despite the driving sleet outside, he was wearing just an open neck shirt over his trousers. His bulging biceps and stomach showed clearly through the wet, cotton fabric. A hand, the size of a shovel, grabbed at Barlow's throat. "I have a bone to pick with you." Barlow deflected the hand. "Piss off, Geordie. Arrest my grandsons and them sweet, innocent boys. They're a pack of nearly well, with the rest of you." Geordie positioned himself with a killer built of his. "A pride of her mother's heart, and she's easily pleased." Barlow rose up on his toes, ready to block the threatened punch. Geordie reeked of whiskey that always made him aggressive. The first blow was only seconds away. Pearson didn't rush to help his superior, Barlow noted. Geordie's face had gone forward with fury. "If I'm down on the Dunlops, I'm not putting up with it no more." Edward put a crooked finger to his mouth and gave a gentle cough. "That rushman Dunlop is anymore, not putting up with it anymore." Geordie looked around and spotted Edward. Fist dropped down, backed off and touched a finger to his forehead. "Major Adair, sir, I didn't see you there." He gave a pass for a wink. "You finish sorting out the Sergeant Major. I'll take anything that's left." Barlow got between them, turned his back on Geordie. "I'll save it that way." Geordie never attacked a man from the rear. Once his egg to release his frustrations, he didn't want to fight. "Edward, what the hell are you talking about? Grammar and construct, for heaven's sake." If he shook some sense into Edward, Geordie would go for him. If he didn't, probably burst with frustration. Edward demanded, "Blackmail. Blackmail being a peeping Tom. Have you finally gone mad?" Edward smiled. "As you're aware, my habitual bed is situated on the Corn's Bridge. I've reached round table fall and a number of the participants retire to the joints and surrounds of the bridge. They're then engaged in social intercourse of a highly intimate nature." "You mean shagging, you dirty old man?" "Shagging? Yes, just now." Edward looked offended. Tor said, Major Dersar, you want me to thump the bugger for you? Thank you, Ralph, not to know. But I'm quite capable of taking care of myself. Barlow didn't know which neck to reinforce. He concentrated on it. So he was. One ascertains, one identifies. A nod here, a week there. I think perfectly civil. My comfort is secured, my edification enhanced. Edward put a piece of paper in his pocket. Proof of my culpability. Last night's participants. Barlow grabbed the proof. Edward's copper plate hand had recorded cars, models, and registration numbers. The number of vehicles involved surprised him. By the holy heaven, you had a busy night. Edward said, one vehicle to group system. Springs need on it. Bloody hell. He looked at the list again. Which one? A press of metal, he choked cry, was borrowed to forget the list. Other signs followed. He couldn't identify them. From the cells, he headed towards the back of the building at a brisk pace. Edward wasn't after him. Go away, my dear chap. Behind Edward came Jordy, part of Lord Jordy, a devil who scared us all. The cry arose again, high pitched and frightened. A number of policemen appeared out of hidey holes and copy holes. Orlin ran behind him as he pushed through a heavy metal door into the cell block. Orlin noticed how tatty the place had become, very few chipped and tired, and an only worn down to colourless. Murder suspect's cell door hung open. Orlin found himself staring into the muzzle of a revolver. Thank you.